thank you all for coming.
My name is Linda Powell Jensen, and I lived in mining town from 1951 to 1955. And the program you're going to see this evening kind of came about by accident. I was invited to come up and do some teaching in an elder hospital, and when we got here, I said, asked what my third program was, and I didn't have one. So I kind of put this together in raw form, and it's been refined. And the narration changes because I was done in 2004, 10 years ago, and things keep changing, including the ending will be changing soon. Anyway, what it's about is to kind of give you a view of the many similarities between the mining town Holden and Holden Village today. And this program was developed for use at the museum where we didn't have PowerPoint, so I'm going to manually advance the DVD and hope I hit the button right. I'm pushing the wrong button. There we go. This is a prospector by the name of J.H. Holden. In 1887, the Great Northern Railroad Company came through this valley, and they made notes of mineral deposits in the area. In 1896, J.H. Holden discovered the ore body in the valley and filed a mining claim, and thus began the history of activity in this beautiful valley. For the next 30 years, different companies had leases and were working in here, digging tunnels, building roads, building initially a railroad bed, trails, trying to determine how to get the ore out of here. At that time, Railroad Creek kind of meandered back and forth across the valley. By the way, I should have made note, those early workers, did you notice how heavy their clothing was? It was pretty primitive conditions up here at that time, if you can imagine, in the late 1890s, early 1900s. And they were living in those little cabins up in the Honeymoon Heights area. These are the first bridges that were built across Railroad Creek. Very crude, wide enough for humans, pack animals, and maybe a little bit of equipment to be moved across. This is one of the early trails for the pack trains coming up from the lake. In 1928, Britannia Mining Company from British Columbia took a lease on the mine, and they bought the property in 1930 and formed Howe Sound Company as a subsidiary. They started building in 1931, the work stopped because of the depression. In 1936, work started again. This roadbed initially was the start of a railroad that had been the plan from some of the earlier companies that had leases in here. But then when they started in 1936, they used this area to start the road building. And as you can see, this is near the top of the switchbacks. If you look at, pardon my pointer, but I'm a walking stick, you can see Lake Chelan down here in the corner. When I did these programs up in the museum, I had one of Rudy Edmund's old fishing poles. Most of the buildings in the mill and mine area and the town site were built in 1936 and 1937. This is building up in the mine area. Production started in 1937, and the first shipment of ore went out on April of 1938. It went with much fanfare. As you can see, everybody was down there sending it off, and when it arrived in Chelan, it was also greeted by many politicians, and they had a parade of the first trucks of ore going down to the railroad station. The town site, which was built, and like I said, most of it finished by 1937, looks very much the same as it did, as it does now, with some changes. The company wanted to have good workers and wanted them to stay here. Unlike many company towns, mining and lumber, workers lived in bunkhouses with just rows of beds. And Houseana anticipated early on that most of the workers would be single, so they built these really nice dorms with two beds to a room. The beds look familiar. Some of you might be sleeping on them. And I'm sure the construction workers are sleeping on some of them right now. But the idea was to have nice facilities to keep good workers. And having the sink, their own personal, and the, you know, their own personal closets was really a positive thing and very much high quality. The dining hall was the main eating area for the single workers. That's the dining hall we're using today. You'll recognize that some of those chairs are still there. The tables around the poles have been removed and the round tables added, but they served very heavy, high-calorie meals. They had a room in the corner where the guys could make their lunches to go underground, and they were, again, high-calorie meals, lots of sweets, pastry. Everything was homemade, of course. And it was very heavy work and hardy workers. The lunch bar for the mining people was very much different than the Hike House bar that we have seen in prior years as villagers. Of course, right now, during construction season, it's looking a little bit, again, like the mining mess hall, but not quite as elaborate. Those guys didn't self-serve. They sat at the tables, and when a platter was empty, they held it up and a waitress replaced it with a full one, so a little bit different. And again, they were running three shifts much of the time, so there were, you know, people in there eating hearty meals regularly. Agape was our hospital. There was a doctor here at all times, and in many years there was also a nurse. It had a doctor's examining room and a four-bed ward. It also had a dentist chair, and a visiting dentist would come in from Chelan periodically to take care of dental needs. In the later years, there were a couple of doctors that delivered babies, and the last baby was born in April of 1957. I have records of, I have names of 17 babies that were born here, and I have complete information on 14 of them. They also built the recreation hall, which you know is the village center. We called it the rec hall. At the time the gymnasium built, it was one of the most modern gymnasiums in the state of Washington. And by the way, you couldn't walk on it with street shoes. You had to use special rubberized shoes, and when they had other activities in there, the floor was covered with canvas. Basketball was very popular during the winter, just as it is with villagers today. And in addition to teams within town, there would be teams come from the outside to play against the Holden Mining Group. And at one of the reunions, a fellow said in the late 1930s, a team from Holden actually won the Washington State Amateur Basketball Championship.
How did they heat that building back then?
Diesel.
Most of the heat was oil. And keep in mind that the village in those days was totally electric. There were the high-voltage power lines that came all the way up Lake Chelan and across Dunkey Mountain and up, because the mine was run on electricity. So we didn't have the power issues you have today. It was fully electric. One of the big events in the gymnasium was the New Year's Eve dance. As you can see, it was a very formal affair. Long dresses for the women, suits and ties for the men. An orchestra came in from Wenatchee. And I will mention that no alcohol was ever served in any public events here in the mining days, and it was not available to purchase in Holden. There was a tavern at the ceremony during the summer. They could go down there, but it was tightly controlled. You could have your own alcohol in your personal homes, and there were parties before and after the New Year's dance, and I'm sure there were bottles out in the snowbanks outside the door, but nothing served public. In addition to the dances, we had movies three times a week. There would be concerts there from time to time. There was an amateur theater group in the 1940s. The 50s, couple of different years, we had talent shows that were fundraisers for the March of Dimes. The movies, they had a low on Wednesday, kids' movie on Friday, and kind of family movie on Sunday nights. And a couple other big events. The community Christmas tree was extremely important to the kids in the village, and everybody in town came. All of the kids up through eighth grade, which is how far our school went, got a Christmas present. You can see them all there. Especially selected for them based on their age and gender. However, that did change slightly in 1952 when gambling was outlawed. The community club no longer had slot machines in the pool hall, and their funds got less, so the big kids after 1952 got applets, little boxes of applets and cotlets. But nevertheless, prior to that, my first introduction to politics. But prior to that time, everybody got an individual gift and got to personally go up and receive their gift from Santa and his helpers. By the way, the program, the picture that you saw there, the program always started with the school kids doing some musical numbers. And to give you an idea of how big the crowd was, you can see that even the balcony was full, and you can see how full the rows of chairs were in that gymnasium. It was pretty full, pretty big event. That's also where we held our church services. In the 1940s, there was a visiting minister that would come in from Wenatchee once or twice a month. And when he was getting ready to leave and go to a different call, Curzon, the general manager, wrote the church and told him it was extremely important that whoever his replacement is would continue to come up and serve Holden. There were a few Catholics that lived here, and on occasion there would be a priest come in and they would have services in their home. In the 1950s, there was a young man that came in here to work in the carpenter shop, and he told us at one of the reunions that when he came here, he was beginning to feel the Lord calling him, and his brother-in-law had told him this would be a good place to come, and the company allowed him. He held non-denominational services weekly, and mothers organized, and we had Sunday school, and they were a basic Christian service with hymn singing and sermons, not a lot of rituals, and like I said, they were non-denominational, but we did have church services, and he stayed here until the mine closed in 57, so we had church services regularly there also. The bowling alley was another important recreation activity provided by the company. The bowling alley and the pin setter machines are still being used today. However, the village has added a little motor on the machines to push them down instead of having to be manually pushed down. But in the mining days, that was one of the ways some of the miners made extra money, was to set pins for lignite. And I will tell you, they were fast, because when we first left here, my brother and I rolled in a high school bowling league, and we went to a bowling alley that had the early automatic pin setters, and they were so slow. Leagues were very competitive. Both men and women had leagues, and the little weekly newspaper carried the standings all throughout the year. And then there was junior bowling for kids age 12 and above. So again, the facility, the idea was to have plenty for people to do to keep good workers here. The pool hall was different in the mining days than it is today. It had a sign above it that said, "No minors allowed," and that was spelled M-I-N-O-R-S. And you had to be 21 to go in there, because in addition to the pool tables, if you look in the back and off to the side, you'll see those nice round poker tables, which were very busy. And isn't it nice that they had those wonderful chairs that you're now sitting on in front of you? That's where your chairs came from, is from the poker tables. The fountain lunch was what you now know as the snack bar, and it was much more than ice cream. As you can see, the stools went from all the way to the door. They also went all the way to the other door, except at each end was a little teeny lift-up section, a counter for the women to get under to get behind to go to work. If you look toward the left, just above the salt and pepper shakers there, you'll see the grill. This is where the hamburgers and the steaks and the french fries and such were made. So this was the restaurant. This is where people went out to dinner. The stools and the counter were the only seating area. The area where the tables are now was walled off, and that was a storage area. When I first came here, people asked me what the lift was, so I had to go see where the lift was. Well, that's where all the cold storage boxes were to keep the meat, frozen meat and ice cream that was used in the fountain lunch. So that was a popular place. School was started in 1938. It was a one-room school with all 8 grades in one room. By 1939, they had added a second room in the back, and they were divided groups, 1 through 4 and 5 through 8. This is a picture of the big room, as we called it, the upper grades, from the 1940s. The little door in the back, if you've been in, any of you that have been inside the school, that little room back there, that was our little library, school library. And the front porch area with the, and I'm not sure what they have in that area now, but the ante room before you went into the main classroom was where we hung all our snowsuits during the winter while we were in school. And we had to wear dresses still, by the way, in those days, so the girls wore long coats over their dresses, and then the snow pants were pulled up under your dress to wear to school. We got an excellent education. This is a picture of the classroom in the 50s that had grown. By 1949, they added the third room on the back, the T that goes out in the back. And by 1953, when the first group of baby boomers hit first grade, they had to open the basement and add a fourth classroom. This picture, I believe, was taken in the winter of 1956, which was the record snowfall up here. And the reason I say that, normally, like everything else, school had its pecking order too. And when you got to the big room, you started in the fifth grade or sixth grade by the blackboards and worked your way to the eighth grade to the windows. But this year, all the desks have been turned with back to the window, and I suspect it's because the snow was totally covering the windows that year. Eighth grade graduation was a significant event in the mining days and very well attended. As you can see, it was also a very formal event. The girls have fancy dresses, the boys are suits and ties, boutonnieres, corsages. I have a personal story about this. The guy on the far right, the young man, that's my older brother Jim. He was the class speaker for the graduation. The barber was out of town, so my mother borrowed a pair of electric clippers from the neighbor to trim up his hair. And just as she started to trim the back of his head, they shocked her. And she zigzagged his head. So his instructions were that when he finished his speech, he could not turn around and his chair had the back all the way. This is a picture that was taken by the Wenatchee World of the last day of school in Holden, and there were almost 120 kids by the time the school closed in 1957. And the teacher, who you saw in that previous picture, Mrs. Field, by the way, taught here from 38 until the school closed. She lived to be 105. She was an outstanding teacher, very influential. Many kids that had Mrs. Field went on to college, both blue-collar and white-collar kids, and there are numerous of them that became teachers as a result of her influence. We had her service down, her service was held at Fields Point Landing. The original married couples that came here when the mine started in 1937, they hired a lot of engineers right out of college, and they were all marrying their college sweethearts. So they weren't going to live in the dorms. They brought their wives, and they moved into the area that is known as Honeymoon Heights. Now, they weren't building new houses up there. What these couples were doing is taking the old cabins and bunkhouses that had been built over the 30 years that those various companies were working up there. They took them and added on to them and remodeled them. I read about there was one small bunkhouse that two families cut it apart and pulled it, separated it, and made a common entry and made a duplex out of it. So they lived up in that area. There were people living up there for a few years. We have a chart of that area, and I think it shows about 13 homes. But when the mine operations started, there was a lot of shaking and vibrating from the mine operations up there. Also, when the town site got built, everything up there was pretty far from town to come up and down. And then the third factor is there is an avalanche chute above, so that area was abandoned pretty quickly. In the meantime, as more miners came with families, they started building the homes up in Winston Camp. This is a winter view of Honeymoon Heights. This is a picture of Chalet Hill, and the company built these homes for the management employees. Some of the people from Honeymoon Heights moved down there when the homes were finished and they were assigned jobs. The house went with the position. The biggest one at the bottom of the hill belonged to the general manager. The second house, which burned in the late 60s, I believe, and has since been rebuilt by the village, Chalet 2 was called a guest house. And it was used when officials from House on Mine headquarter offices in New York would come out. Also, there were mining people that came from other parts of the world to look at this mine. It was considered very modern, state-of-the-art operation, and other mining people would come to look at what was being done here. So the guest house was used for that. And also, it had an attic, I might mention, that had costumes from our various activities, and I'll talk about our plays, but just like you have a costume shop today, we had what we called our costume box, boxes full of costumes in Chalet 2. Chalet 3 was the chalet where single management employees lived, and from there on up the hill, it went by the job title. And the titles did change somewhat over the years, but people who got a promotion, my friend from Seattle, his dad was chief engineer and then became mine superintendent, so they moved like four houses down the hill. The family homes were built in Winston. Now, if you've walked up there and see a foundations, I want you to be aware there were 101 homes up there. And they were nice-sized homes. They were like the chalets. They were equivalent to things being built on the outside. They weren't mining shacks. And I get asked, I brought my pointer here. This is my home right down here on the first row. The houses were built in rows, up the hill, bottom row, middle row, and top row, and that was your address. That's where you lived, either bottom row, and your dad's name was on that. Like I said, they were very nice homes. This is a picture of the first row, and if you go up there today across from the Forest Service cabin, you will see that a rock wall is starting to get crumbled a little bit by trees, and they were discussing that they need to get the Forest Service to cut the trees because that rock wall is historic quality now. But as you can see, these were nice size. That fourth house in there was actually a three-story house plus the basement. The family that originally built it had 10 kids. And that shiny, the little building on the left-hand side there above the stop sign is a garage, and that actually went with our house. Our house is pretty much hidden in this picture because of the three-story house. But again, if you go up there today, you can find that rock wall. Now, this particular block is where the drain field was put, so none of the foundations are there. But this is a winter shot of the same area taken a little bit further up the hill. And that beautiful tree that you see there actually was in our front yard. This is a winter shot of the middle row of houses. It gives you some idea how much the snow got up. And again, you can see enough of the houses to realize they were very nice-sized houses. This is a group of Boy Scouts getting ready to go out on a camporee on the outside. We had youth activities. We had Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, Bluebirds, Campfire Girls, and they were heavily supported. The Forest Service cabin was the Campfire Girls' meeting cabin, and the Boy Scouts had a very lovely log cabin at the other end of Winston Camp that was their meeting house. So we had plenty of youth activity and things for to do. And of course, today, not right now while guests aren't here, but when guests come during the summer months, they have minors and junior minors programs for youth, and then of course they have the Narnia programs. So just like the village today, we had our youth activities also. Oops, I moved the room a bit again. Every spring, the school group put on some type of a music program, usually an operetta of some sort. This year, they were doing the Frog Prince, and I mentioned the costume box. Some of the costumes, the king and queen, were retained from the costume box. The prince and frog uniforms, and I believe the butler's uniform, were actually rented from Wenatchee, as was the year they did Jack and the Beanstalk. The chicken was brought in from the outside. But they... mothers, just like you do today, you may do with what you had, and we had also had square dancing that year as part of our PE, and the upper grade square dancing was pretty popular, and several of us are wearing our square dancing dresses, and you'll see the black cummerbunds. The mothers made the cummerbunds for the square dance dresses, and we were the maids in the play. And I should mention, the scenery was painted by the students also. Bus arrival and departure was a big event in the mining days, just like it is today. Not as much fanfare, but you didn't get to go out very often. So if you were going, it was very much a dress-up affair. And you can see the ladies are in their finest coats and the guy in the sports coat. And if you had company arriving, you would be there to greet the bus, of course. The other important part of the bus arrival is frequently some of the women would come down to be there when the bus arrived, because that meant the mail would soon be in the mailboxes. Fourth of July and Labor Day were big events in the mining days, an all-day affair picnic. In the morning, they started with races for the kids and contests for age groups. We had three-legged races, gunny sack races, high jumping. And the prizes were our tin money, which were 50-cent pieces that you could spend only in town here. And they had the races both Labor Day. We didn't have parades on the 4th of July, although the kids in the 40s said it was pretty, those kids were pretty common. They'd decorate their bicycles and kind of parade up to the ballpark with their decorated bicycles. They also had nail driving and log sawing contests for the women. And in early years, and they had needle threading and egg and spoon races for the men. Pie eating contest was very popular too. They used two crusted berry pies that had to be eaten with no hands and kind of a gooey mess on their face. When we came here, my brother got into that one right away. He actually unseated the guy who had been defending champion for 2 years. So another fun activity. At noon, there was a huge picnic up at the picnic area. Now, that picnic area was located just west of the ballpark, which is where there's, I think there's a small campground there today. The stone fireplace, which you see in the middle, that yellow sign, yellow and white sign is hanging on the big stone fireplace, isn't there anymore. The company sponsored the 4th of July picnic, and the union sponsored the Labor Day picnic. And there was plenty of food for all. And again, though, no alcohol served at this function either. As I mentioned, we didn't have parade in the mining days, but in 1952 and 53, there was a lady here whose husband worked on transportation crew, and she'd been a majorette at Chelan High School, so she started a little baton twirling group. And so our mothers made us our red skirts, and we all wore white tops. And the hats are made out of oatmeal boxes with fabric glued on and yarn tassels. And so we performed at the ballpark at the 4th of July after lunch.
Wait, Linda, which one is you?
Which one is me?
Yes.
There's from the right.
I don't know if I can.
Yeah, I'm there. This after lunch baseball was the big event, and I want to point out, notice the bleachers over there that went up the hillside that goes along where the trail goes now. And on this side of the backstop, there was also about three rows of bleachers. I also want to point out, I think if you look real hard right above this guy's head, you can kind of see the flag hanging there in the, against the trees. It's not unfurled because it wasn't wind blowing, but we had our flagpole, and of course, the morning had started with the flag raising. Baseball was big during the summer, not only the teams within town, but teams would come from the outside to play against the mining, and there's a big article in some of the news clippings in the museum. There was one summer that a group of airmen from Larson Air Force Base came up and spent the weekend and played baseball against our teams. Skiing was our very popular winter sport. We had a ski area up on the edge of Winston Camp, and we had a rope tow. You can see the rope there. There was a big pole at the bottom with a huge wheel off an ore truck, and then the motor was actually on a toboggan, and when there was enough snow, they'd take it up to the top of the course and hook it up. 1954 winter, avalanche came down and wiped it out, but they did rebuild it, and it was still running till the end of the mining years. And a very popular activity, the Boy Scouts sometimes had ski races. This is another shot showing it was a pretty good sized course, Bonanza in the background there. And sledding, of course, was extremely popular. This was the big ski, big, most popular sledding hill. There was others you could do that were longer. By the way, people ask me where the ski area is. It used to be hard to describe, but right now with the bypass trail that you're using, if you go to the ballpark, when you get to the intersection, the last intersection where this sledding hill goes down, but up to the right, there's a bombardier sitting up there, and they've got Rudy's outhouse moved up there. Right up behind that bombardier and just off to the left is where the rope tow started. So that's where our ski area was. And this, is, as I said, was the popular sledding hill. Unfortunately, by 1957, The ore body was running out, the mill was worn out, and copper prices had dropped drastically. So in April, the company announced that the mine would close on July 1. Some of the people dismantled their houses. They actually hauled the lumber out and built a new house somewhere else. Most people moved some of their belongings or all of their belongings. Some people left a lot of things behind because if you were going very far, it was too expensive to ship furniture across country, so they just left things here. And you've probably heard about, you know, somebody left everything behind. A friend of ours hiked in the year after it closed. He'd been a neighbor, and he said that he found the house up in the new addition. He couldn't remember which one it was, but it looked like they had actually set their table and ate their last meal ceremoniously and then left. So they had left dishes on the table as if they'd had their last meal. But it was a sad time. And as we knew when we bought our houses, that if the mine closed, we would have so many years to salvage things, and then the Forest Service came in and burned, and they were burned in the spring of 1963 when there was about, then in March when there was still snow on the ground. And thus starts a new era. This is another prospector of a different kind. This man's name is Wes Preeb, and I'm sure you've heard of Wes Preeb, and those who've been fortunate enough to meet him know what a super guy he was. Wes saw advertisement for a mining town for sale, and he wrote to inquire about it, and he kept writing letters to inquire about it, and when they couldn't sell it, they sent him a telegram, and that's because of his persistent effort, this property was donated to the Lutheran Bible Institute in Seattle, which of course ultimately became the Holden Village Group. So we are very grateful to Wes and our prospector guy. And here's the early workmen from the mine, the village days. These are the forerunners. This group came in 1961 to do cleanup and repair. That's their bus, by the way, that they came on. It was a brand new 1961 International truck, and that's how they got here. And their clothing is a little different, but I can tell you the working conditions were just as crude as those guys we saw earlier. This is a group of the leaders sitting on the lawn. The lady on the left, named Bertha, was their cook. She cooked their meals on an old wood stove and also used the stone fireplaces behind the chalets. The guy in the middle with the hat is Gil Bird, and he was one of the people in Seattle instrumental in getting this property started. And their first time here was repair and cleanup. Here are some guys up on the hotel building doing repair work. A lot of the mattresses were still in the dorms. They're hanging them all out to dry. Cleaning dorm rooms. Look at the wall that isn't clean yet. Gives you an idea. We got 4 years of grime here. They've been closed since 57, and they came in 61. And this one really shows it. The clean window versus the dirty window. Also, there unfortunately, there had been vandalism, and many of those little windows were broken. They started a tradition, kind of the way it has always been, you know, make use of what's available. After they had been here a while, a generator was brought in. So they went up to the miners' village and found an old wringer washing machine that helped take care of their laundry issues. They also followed very much what we know today in the village. They had their work time. They had daily Bible study. The forerunners will tell you, if you ever watched their DVD, they did some of their Bible study. Sometimes they'd hike up and do the Bible study on Martin Ridge. They had a nature professor here, so they had study sessions, just as we have programs, and they did recreation. This is a picture of them on one of their hikes. And they had their daily worship, and despite the primitive issues, they did dress up for services. This is a picture from Martin Ridge of what it looked like when they arrived in 1961. I believe this picture was taken in 1960, and you can see how bare the tailings were at that time. This is a picture of Chalet Hill. The antenna is still on the house. There was a few people with TVs. Now you'll note there were hardly any trees in the yard. Of course, trees have grown back up now, and most all the yards have trees. This is a picture of what Winston looked like when they came in '61. The houses were still here at that time, although they were empty, and there's that rock wall. This is a picture after the burning. This is a picture of the middle row. That house on the right had that beautiful big stone fireplace. That's where the school teacher lived. Her husband operated the crane. Again, you can get an idea of the nice size of the houses. And this is that same area after the burning was done. And this is the footbridge that was in place when the village came. That was the last one built by the mining company and the one that was used to transition to the new community. This is Carol and Mary Hindenley. He was the first director, and they operated the village from 1963 to 1977. And basically set the tone that has followed that I mentioned, you know, volunteer labor, data worship, teaching programs, and recreation. They also started the themes way back in 1965, which, by the way, means that Love Before the Foundation of the World this summer is the 50th summer theme for Holden Village. They put the dining hall to good use. As you can see at this point, they're still using it with the old tables around the post. And the chairs are still there. The dining hall became much more than an eating place. In the 60s, they started the Beanie Sings. That's Beanie at the piano. They still have, I think the village still has a songbook, don't they, Steph?
Yes.
And occasion do Beanie Sings. Lots of the Beanie Sings are tunes we all know with Holden words. And this is the first bridge that was built by the village to go across to replace the old mining footbridge. Bus arrival and departure is a big event, and of course now we have that nice new loading dock to handle all the luggage, plus all the hiking gear. We didn't have all that type of equipment because our recreation in the mining days was primarily hiking to the fishing holes, not just hiking, so a little bit different. But again, coming and going, very important activity. And this is a picture of early services in the village center. This was before the ceiling was painted. But as you can see, again, the village center was used for multiple occasions and services very full during the summer. And this is a picture of the high school prom. Again, multiple uses. The village also has concerts there and dances. I didn't have a picture from the village days when we were doing this program, so the fellow that was here helping me with the slides, we went to the balcony and tried to get in relatively the same position as that picture was taken from the mining days. The outfits are a little different here. Some of them came from home and some came from the costume shop, as you can tell. But again, the prom is a very important event, just like the New Year's dance was for us. And here's a picture of the Koinonia, this lovely fireside room for education. This picture was taken before the fireplace was removed, which seemed to be a great idea, but what they determined, it totally sucked all the heat out and it was quickly removed. And then when they started having overhead projectors, it was in the way. So now we just have this lovely candles in the middle. This is the village school. This is a picture of the elementary room. Now, the village school was started in 1972, and it has kindergarten through 12th grade, so it has all grades, and it's divided to elementary, which is kindergarten, if they have one, through 6th grade, and then 7th through 12th grade. And this, at this time, the elementaries were in the back room. I think they've switched around now, and the school has been remodeled considerably from the mining days. This is a picture of the teacher in elementary with, I think Forrest was a kindergartner that time. Was it 2012 that Forrest was here, the strappy big teenager, Stephanie?
I think it was.
Yeah. I looked at him and I'm going like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And this was the secondary room. And these pictures were taken in early 2000. And the high school graduation is a significant event, just as eighth grade was for us, and the whole community participates. The girl on the left in the red next to Scott, the teacher, is a graduate for that year. And they kind of choose how they do their own graduation. I was here one year when we started at the loading dock and followed the drum all the way to the third level, those who could walk. And then we sat on, they had some kind of big foam blocks they pulled out of somewhere that they had bedspreads over, and we sat on those. And right in the middle of the commencement address, a would-be jet came screaming down the valley, so she had her own personal flyby. Another year I was here, they did a progressive graduation in that the graduate was just one that year too, and the teachers plus all the parents who had assisted with teaching various subjects came in caps and gowns at the game room across from the snack bar and down the stairs, and all the assistant teachers either their hat or they had a sash hanging that denoted what they had taught, like the lady who taught music had a violin on her head instead of a mortarboard. And they had a couple of speeches there. Then we went up Chalet Hill to where she lived, and her classmates talked about her. And then we went to the dining hall and had some more speeches talking about her. And then we came back to the gym, and the school authorities did the official presentation, so it was a progressive graduation. But again, just like in the mining days, significant community event and everybody's involved. And of course, plays. The village have plays. The kids, school kids put on plays all the time. This is one that was done one summer. They had an evening with Disney, and as you can see again, you use what's available for costumes because those mop heads make great beards. West Parade turned the pool hall into a family place, and of course it's a wonderful recreation thing. And he decorated all the walls, and they made the game room in the back. The poker tables got removed. Maybe that's refinished what the round tables are in the dining hall, I don't know. But anyway, that game room and the pool room. So it's very different today, and the jukebox was added quite a few years back.
Linda, we have one of the original poker tables at Chalet 6.
You have what?
One of the poker tables at Chalet 6. It has the flat sign on it where the dealer stood.
Is that the one that was used in the Now and Then picture that was in Village Boys?
I don't know. Because it's been there since we've lived there.
So they do have one preserved. That's cool. Yeah. Those were very busy tables. I've been told. I wasn't there. We weren't allowed in there. In the early years, the village had 4th of July races also. This is a picture taken from the 70s, and there's a second picture close to the finish line showing West Preve jumping in front and going across to be the winner. Standing off to the side as they come, he jumped in front. But now, on the 4th of July, they have a marathon that usually starts at a loading dock, and they follow a course, and everybody guesses their time, and then the winner is the one who comes closest to their guess time. They had pie eating contests back in the 70s, too. Now, they used cream pies. I think they were early to eat, but they're sure a lot messier. Look at it dripping off their faces. And strike up the band. You haven't seen a 4th of July parade until you've been to the 4th of July at Holden Building. And the work groups try very hard to be as creative as they can, and many of them work the theme into the summer parade. This one references Carol's new clothes, and I can't remember what the theme was that year, but they have different ones. Only wise can see, I'm not sure what. For the 40 years in the wilderness celebration, they had a very large band, and one of the favorite entries in that one was the Hike House. Moses came wandering down the street looking for water, and he fell down in the middle of the street, and the rest of the team came with the wilderness rescue gurney, and one of the Hike House carried their sign that says, Moses lacked the 10 essentials. We had a huge band that year. The fella in the skirt with the trumpet, Marv Landsberg, his dad was actually one of the early presidents of the board and on the board for quite a few years. He was a music teacher, organized a large band. The band here, well, first I should mention the drill teams. There was a group of gals that had been in drill team in high school. Got to show you their lovely pom-poms. They found these feathery plants down on the nature trail. They had pom-poms, and they the drill team. And then the band, here is a picture. They did the Red Sea formation, and you can see the chariot there, the garden cart. When Pharaoh started through the open sea, then the band closed on him. The baton twirler's baton is a genuine Holden baton. It is made from a broken pool stick. There's fabric from the craft shop. There's a rock from nature, which is affixed at the end for balance with using book tape from the library. So that's a genuine Holden baton, and yeah, that's that 10-year-old, 50 years later.
And so that's right, Dave Durant. I can't believe we're not going to have you for the 4th of July this year.
Well, I'm kind of disappointed to miss it, too. Actually, last year I wasn't there, but I'm not sure I can do that anymore.
She's good. You won't believe it. She throws that.
And picnics. Of course, in Holden Village, although it's different this year, summer picnics are a regular event. They're not just restricted to the 4th of July, but again, enjoyed outside much more frequently than we were able to.
Squirrels are really fun.
And of course, the skiing now, instead of the rope toe skiing, the cross country skiing is popular, and I know that they have people coming in doing snowboarding here too, and of course, lots of snowshoeing. And you can borrow a plastic sled to ride down Chalet Hill. They're a little hard to steer, I found out, compared to the ones that we had that had the metal runners and steering things. I was going down a few years ago, and Chuck came running out all concerned because I kind of crashed in the snowbank. One of the changes of the village converting from industrial to the lovely retreat center is all the gorgeous flower baskets. Unfortunately, Janice isn't able to have them up during construction time, but during normal guest years, there's many beautiful baskets around the village, including a few historic ones that are shown that the early ladies made the hanging baskets out of wire baskets from the what we call the dry building, the change house, where the miners changed and showered after work. They had little baskets to put their hats and clothes in and put them up on pulleys to dry. And the ladies took those wonderful square baskets and made gorgeous flower baskets out of them. And this is another service in the center after the ceiling was painted, which I believe was done in 1976. And now we have another sturdy bridge. Now, usually I end my program saying, hopefully this beautiful bridge will be here for many generations to come. But that might be changing soon, because it sounds like we may have another bridge before construction is over. But anyway, this gives you a picture of what the two communities were like. It's many similarities, and yet changes as it's been converted to the retreat center. Besides the flower boxes, I should mention the beautiful iris beds, many of which have been temporarily relocated. In the early 60s, Gertrude Lundholm and some ladies spent 2 months one summer digging up iris beds from the miners' village. The chalets had flower beds, but none of those company buildings had flower beds around them. And they brought all those iris down, hauled them down, screened soil, and planted all the gorgeous flower beds down here. So that's one of the things, again, that carries forward from our time. You have our flowers, too.
I noticed there's a lilac bush up in Lincoln Town, too. There's a great big lilac up on the hill.
There's several of them up there. I noticed the white one was still in bloom when I arrived. But it's fantastic. The rain has kind of wiped it out. But again,
those have been around.
By the way, there's a book in the bookstore, a story about the iris. I also want to mention two other books that I've mentioned at my other programs. Company Towns of the Pacific Northwest was researched by Linda Carlson. She spent 2 years, and it writes about company towns in Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. And one of the things we learned from reading that is Holden was really a very good company town. The bookstore is out right now of copies to purchase, but Katie let me know the library does have two copies, and Bruce is going to see about getting them in. The other book that's in there that is of interest, there is a copper-colored book, a small book that it has a lot of photographs in it, taken from the early years by a man named Larry Penberthy, and he has pictures of both the community and the mining town. So again, hopefully this gives you an idea of what the communities are like and why there are so many similarities. For those of us who were kids here, it was a great place to grow up, and the first thing we noticed, most of us when we came back, especially me, is when you come, when there's guests and lots of children in the village, it's a very happy place for kids too. And I think that's the thing that struck me the very first time I came back. So a lot of similarities between the two, and those of us from the mining community are very grateful that Holden Village is here, because many people who grew up in mining towns do not have anywhere to go back to. We do. Thank you all very much.